Over the past year and a half, me and my family have been through a number of life-changing moments. Most, if not all of you, have experienced similar things. These experiences put you in a zone of uncomfortable thoughts sometimes, and emotions, a time of sobering and somber reflection. This afternoon, I'd like to share a few personal takeaways that I've learned so far in these personal journeys. So what are these personal experiences I'm talking about? In the past year and a half, I've been a pallbearer and buried family and close friends on numerous occasions. My father died on my 65th birthday, and a few years ago, my older sister died on Passover evening of cancer. The wife of my best friend, we were each other's best man, recently died a couple of months ago after a lifelong battle of cancer. So you can think, well, this is going to be a really fun sermonette. But there are some lessons to take away that I'd just like to share with you. I'm not being morose. And these are not unique experiences. Many of you can relate and tell your own stories. But they do make you stop. They do make you stop and reflect and consider whether what we're doing right now is really all that important. I remember many years ago in 1975, back in the Upper Paleozoic era, when I was listening to a minister talk about how we were all blades of grass, vapors and mists, the span of the universe. Back then, I was invulnerable. I was young, active, and I didn't need to give much thought to things like those biblical metaphors. So in this short time of a sermonette, I'd like to briefly relate three and personal and brief points of what I've learned. And I'm not trying to make anyone uncomfortable, and if this isn't your cup of tea, it's okay to check your phone or zone out and review something else. But the first point I'd like to relay is operational. When people get in the sorts of situations like my family's been over the last year, with a recent slow death and passing of Jamie's brother, Wayne, one thing that everyone appreciates is human contact. Emotions swell and crash, and when you're watching and experiencing someone who has fought and is losing a battle, no matter how valiantly. Personal cards, emails, texts, phone calls, however short or abbreviated, often make a huge impact. The card that you all signed us recently was gratefully appreciated, as were the many texts and phone calls that Jamie and I received in contact directly with her brother, who attended church many years ago with Jamie's parents, and remembers a number of people in this room. Without hopefully offending anyone, I would like to call out Marilyn's story for her beautiful cards to Wayne, because and the cards that you all sent. Particularly when Wayne got a card from Mary Lynn, he was shocked. He goes, "These people actually remember me from long ago, and they were personally inscribed, and it was very encouraging." Especially as hope faded and heavy discouragement laid on his heart. It touched him so much he wanted to come to church. He said that several times. And he wanted to personally thank each and every one of you who signed cards and thought of him and prayed for him. He never made it to services, but he did make it here. He did get a chance to come right before the Sabbath brunch, and he actually put together one of the portable stands. And as recently as 2 weeks ago, he was talking about coming here and hanging those heavy doors. He kind of worked it out with Jamie how he was going to do it. So the takeaway here is that when anyone's going through something like this, you can make a difference. You don't think you will. You go, if you're like me, you go, well, the only thing I ever say to anybody in situations like that is really clumsy and stupid. Everybody's nodding their heads. Thanks. Seriously, you think that way, but it's not. Any touch is grateful. There, you search for the right thing to say, and in reality, there is no need to think of the right thing to say because there is no right thing. Just your presence is great. The human presence, whether in the form of a card, an online acknowledgement, or acknowledgement that you're praying for someone online, or a brief visit even at the funeral service, which many of you did, made a huge difference. It makes a huge difference. So I just can't underestimate to you or express to you in underestimated terms how powerful that is. The second point that I'd like to relate that I learned in this is of being a light. Because you don't think about that when somebody's in the process of battling a terrible illness. You don't think about being a light at all. You think about what's going on. But it's really powerful, and it's particularly important to be a light to those with whom we previously shared fellowship. What am I talking about here? I experienced a remarkable phenomenon at recent funerals, not only just the one with Wayne, but others that I've been to that involved church members or relatives of people who broke from our prior fellowship or even our current one. So last Sunday's funeral for my brother-in-law was a case in point. There were many longtime friends that Wayne had made way back in the 60s and 70s who remembered him and hung out with him, and they all came to his funeral. There were considerable numbers. And as a number personally commented to me, many of those people carry hurts and resentments, some perfectly legitimate, from their prior experiences. So I found, remarkably, that in some instances, this type of situation, however unpleasant it is for me, offers a chance to re-engage with some of these people. As the health of my brother-in-law declined, some friends dropped by and paid an extended visit. In some instances, they reminisced at length about church services and their personal experiences, some good, some not so good. But for certain, these former associates of our fellowship had their hypocrisy detecting radar in full strength when they were talking to me. They wanted to know why I was still hanging around. They wanted to know why I came back to United after the split in 95. And I can tell you one, they didn't want a stock answer. So I believe in many cases there's a spiritual hole in these people's lives. There was an experience that they had. They all talked about the feast like it was yesterday. They talked about getting together with people, and they had all these stories. And it was like you could sense that if it weren't for a bit of pride, they would drop by. And they might listen a little bit more, and they might think about things. So for me, it was an opportunity simply to show that our fellowship does in fact have strong and remarkable value. But what happened to these former associates? I don't know. I don't think God wastes any opportunities. We've had people ask us, you know, where do you guys go to church now, Young Building? And as Mike Kubik will tell you, our newly invigorated Google business thing has gotten thousands of hits. So what are these people going to do? I don't know, but it's an opportunity. So my point is, if you ever find yourself in a funeral or a similar situation, be a welcoming and friendly light. We're all human, and every human makes mistakes. As Paul, John, and even Jesus Christ himself pointed out in the Bible, the first century disciples had their own share of division and organizational challenges. This is not new. When former associates of our fellowship see friendly, non-judgmental people, I can tell you it has an impact. So to help illustrate my third and final point, I'd like to tell you about an aunt of mine. She went through the Great Depression, and my aunt had a unique way of minimizing and stretching certain things. One of the things she liked to do, this is where we're all supposed to say bless her heart, she used to make iced tea. Or a better way to describe it, she made a watery drink that sometimes resembled iced tea. She would take a giant thing of water, well, a couple of quarts, and she put one level teaspoon of instant iced tea in it. So it turned this water kind of a faint brown. It was epitome of unsweetened tea because it didn't have any sweetener. And the ice bit was optional. So she would hand you a glass of this faint brown water, with or without ice, and expect you to drink it. Needless to say, it wasn't terribly satisfying. My point is, and to illustrate, I've found a similar experience when I go to funerals where the theology of our eternal reward kind of resembles my great aunt's brown water. There are elements in it, these services of what the Bible teaches, but it's incredibly diluted and it often lacks key ingredients. I recently heard a preacher talk about how my father prayed to the Trinity, which left our entire family puzzled. Preacher said that prayer got him sent to a celestial place of eternal happiness. Maybe my father did say such a prayer, but I lived with him near him for nearly six decades, including Winston and my wife and family, spending a lot of time on occasion talking about the Bible, and never once did he ever talk about a Trinity. He did worry a little bit about going to hell, but he never expressed any faith in the other. I also heard recently, in the past year or so, a lot of fractured stories of people being reunited with their loved ones. At this very moment, as we're sitting in a funeral parlor, they can see us, and we should take comfort in this somehow. It makes me sad. Actually, it makes me very sad. I never hear preachers outside the faith, or I never have, maybe you have, talk about this resurrection chapter in 1 Corinthians 15. They just kind of pass right over that. And I never have heard anybody quote Job 14:15, where these incredibly comforting words that describe the moment of resurrection to eternal life appear. That verse says, "You shall call," talking of God, "and I will answer you. You shall desire the work of your hands." That's a promise to each one of us. The book of Job is potentially the oldest book in the Bible, and that is preserved for us. But nobody quotes it, and it makes me sad. So what's my point? Well, there's two parts of my first point. I'm following Mr. Vincent's example here. This is point 3.1. Funerals conducted by people outside of our fellowship make me very grateful. They make me grateful for the truth of God that we understand. The contrast, particularly at the height of grieving and emotional turmoil, is profound. There is real comfort in the truth. There is only kind of a syrupy, kind of artificial sweetness to the other. I know my family and I and all of you worship and follow a loving God, one who desires that all should be saved. We don't worship a pagan deity who is struggling against forces of darkness to somehow try and get everyone saved in a Harry Potter kind of plot before the final curtain rings down and billions of people who never heard of or understood the Bible are condemned to an eternity of suffering and hellfire, tormented endlessly by demons. We don't believe any of that, because none of it's true. It's a fractured, terrible version of what really is. Knowing this doesn't make me feel superior or self-righteous. It just makes me feel humble. It makes me feel quietly grateful. The Bible plainly acknowledges that death brings painful separation. The Bible tells us we will all share that faith once, unless we're the fortunate ones that rise up and meet Christ in the air. The Bible tells us that we are not promised immortal life in this human existence, that we don't have an immortal soul, as Plato espoused. The Bible tells us that God is in charge and that everything has a purpose. The second part of my third point, point 3.2, is that while feeling grateful to know the truth, I'm also reminded that faith without works is dead. The loss of my brother-in-law, a quiet man who did great things from building homes from famous people like Governor Mitch Daniels and Colts owner Jim Irsay. He also made sure that people who worked for him were taken care of, including quietly paying the salary of his brother Jack, Jamie's older brother, as Jack fought and ultimately lost his own battle with cancer. This gives me a renewed hope and also a sense of urgency to work on myself. I submit to you that today, you and I have a choice. As we read in Ecclesiastes 9, verse 4, quoting for the New Living Translation, quote, "Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better than a dead lion." Well, of course, I don't think any of us are dogs, but the point is taken. As long as we draw breath, we have a choice. We have a choice to get out of our comfort zones and yield ourselves to God for spiritual growth. Since we're about a few weeks out from Passover and the days of unleavened bread, the times which we know and understand can have deep personal impact, I redid a guide for a spiritual inventory, which I'm not going to go through now, but I brought some copies for it. Previously distributed this is updated. So if you like a copy after services, I'd be happy to give you one. It goes through it as a checklist of traits of spiritual characteristics of self-will as opposed to characteristics of people seeking God's will. It's a nice little checklist because you go through it. If you're like me, the checks are on the wrong side, so it's time to push them over. And I can't do that. I know God can. These days and seasons are precious guideposts that help us renew and refocus our lives. God Himself, through Jesus Christ, acts to remove these faults of character and improve our lives. So it's a worthy endeavor. So in closing, I'd like to read from the book of Lamentations. Lamentations is a book of grief and horror that we don't normally look at. The Catholics read it the last couple of days of the Easter season. And Jews read it during, I think it's the 8th day of Ahab. You'd have to ask Dr. Cox about the exact date. But they do read it. It was written immediately after the destruction of the first temple and the fall of Judah in captivity in 586 B.C. And it reflects the fulfilling in part the prophecies for disobedience that God declared in the Torah. The Lamentations, before I read it to you, has some unique qualities. They're very notable. The entire book, like much of the Bible, is poetry. So you can ask people like Kate Washburn why people write in poetry. It's to underscore and emphasize critical facts. Makes it memorable. It also heightens understanding when used poetry. Interestingly enough, Lamentations is mostly written in what they call acrostics, which is the letters of the Hebrew Bible, and so each word, beginning of each verse, starts with a letter in sequence of the Hebrew Bible to promote memorability. The third chapter, which is the spiritual peak of the book, recognized by scholars and readers alike, is unusual in that it's written in triple acrostics. That really underscores what it's trying to say. The third chapter is where we're going to end this sermon at. Please turn with me to the third chapter of Lamentations, where we'll start in verse 17 using the English Standard Version. Here we read in verse 17, "My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, my endurance has perished, and so has my hope in the Lord." This is written at a time of terrible fallout and devastation. The author goes on and says, "Remember my affliction, my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. My soul continually remembers and is bowed down within me." Horrible pity, terrible depression. Not happy conditions. But what was the ultimate outcome there? Now, what's the spiritual peak in a triple acrostic? "But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. And they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul, therefore I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait on him, to the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord." The only thing that mars that reference is the references to soul. Robert Alter, who's a Hebrew scholar, probably one of the premier Hebrew scholars on Hebrew poetry, wrote his own translation of the Bible. It's been a big popular piece in the last year or so. It's been about 10 years in the making. And so he doesn't believe and can show you how soul is nowhere justified in the Bible. And it's a Protestant mishmash. And so he changes it. And instead of having soul, he has life, heart, or person, which are equally good for the nephesh piece. He says, "I answer to my heart, yet I hope. And good is the Lord for those who look to him, for the person who seeks after him." And the highlight of that triple acrostic, written by Alter, or translated, "The Lord's kindness has not ended, for his mercies are not exhausted. They are renewed every morning, and great is your faithfulness." So we live in serious times. In these days before a possible coronavirus epidemic, let us renew a sense of urgency to love one another, to be a light, particularly to those who once walked with us, to cherish the precious truth that we have been given, and to renew our personal hope, for the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning, and great is the faithfulness of our God.